It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Boy, the week just started out with a bang. Looks like we have a new...
there was an assassination?
No. I mean, there probably was, but I not talking about that. Talking about, it looks like we have a new face for our Supreme Court.
Yes, we have a successful coup d'etat over the third branch of government. It's a very exciting development. It's been kind of interesting because there's been this great brouhaha all week over Maria Cantwell's vote to close debate in the Senate and end the filibuster. And, of course, she voted for that, and then she voted against Alito on the floor. So there's been this debate in blogs and other progressive forums all week about should we support Cantwell's reelection, and you know, she's stood people up, and people again started pointing to her defense of her original vote on the Iraq War, and making the completely accurate observation that her take on Iraq is basically indistinguishable from George Bush's. And it's been kind of disingenuous. I mean, we have Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court for one reason and one reason only, and that is that the Democrats didn't really mount any kind of aggressive campaign to try and stop the nomination. There was a last-minute filibuster that was spearheaded by a couple of senators, and it attracted a good deal of support, certainly not unanimous support among the Democrats, and it failed, not surprisingly. It didn't have the support of the Democratic leadership at all, and there was really no effort among the Democrats, as we've talked about on this program a number of times, to try and stop the nomination. The attitude within the Senate from Halloween, when Alito was originally nominated, appropriately enough, all the way through the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings in January, was, well, we'll wait and see. We'll see what he has to say during the hearings. Even though literally within hours of his nomination on Halloween, people like People for the American Way were circulating these long, detailed lists of decisions and dissents that Alito had made on the federal bench that pretty clearly demonstrated what kind of a Supreme Court justice he would make. I mean, there's never any kind of doubt as to where this guy was coming from. But for whatever reason, the Democrats chose not to fight it from the get-go, and chose not to fight it at the end either, and never chose to fight it really during the middle either. But part of that was a political calculus, and the political calculus was that there was not that much public opposition to Alito's nomination. There was a great flurry of activity by progressives over the last two or three days before the Senate vote, but that kind of activity should have been happening since Halloween, since November 1st, and it didn't. So you have to look at Cantwell's vote in that context, and in the context that she has been a centrist from the get-go. That's how she was originally in the House of Representatives in the early 90s. That's what she's been as a senator. She's done some good things on Anwar and other issues, but she's basically been a moderate. She's more conservative than Patty Murray is. She is very much from the DLC wing of the Democratic Party, and she's never made any secret about that. She is who she is. She is not going to go against her political instincts and her political roots and firmly oppose the Alito nomination unless she's given a compelling political reason during a reelection campaign to do that. And she was not given that reason. There simply wasn't enough pressure on her from liberals, from progressives, from people who opposed the Alito nomination, for her to make that kind of a stance, unless it was simply a matter of her own conscience. And there's nothing in her record to indicate that she's, going to make those kind of stands. So, I wasn't at all surprised by her vote. And I was kind of surprised at how much debate there is over, should we support this woman? We don't have any new information on Cantwell now that we didn't have last week, that we didn't have last month, that we didn't have last year. She is who she is. And, is that better than Mike McGavick, her Republican opponent, come November? Sure it is. But is it what you would want from a Democratic senator in the state of Washington? Probably not. And the question is, do you support somebody like Mark Wilson, who's running against her in the Democratic primary, somebody like Aaron Dixon, I believe, is rumored to be. I'm thinking of something else. But I'm thinking about the right. Aaron Dixon is rumored to be considering mounting a Green Party challenge to that seat. So there will be opponents to Cantwell who are far more progressive than she is, and that option is out there. If people want to support a progressive alternative to the current junior senator from Washington, that can be done. Until progressives get organized enough in the political process to force Democrats to start taking their political base seriously, they're going to just continue to get a word that I can't really use on the radio. It's just going to continue to happen because the Democratic Party, by and large, takes its base for granted, does not respond to the desires and needs of that base, particularly the more moderate, the more conservative Democratic Party leadership, the Hillary Rodham Clintons of the party. And Maria Cantwell is very much of that ilk.
All right. And then Tuesday, we had the State of the Union, which I'm sure you were glued to.
God, that was bored. I was in the intensive care unit, and there was this guy whose liver was shot, who was screaming at the top of his lungs throughout the speech, which I thought was more than a little appropriate. It wasn't a response to Bush. He was in a great deal of pain, but and I don't think that was because of Bush. But Bush really didn't say anything new in the State of the Union this year. It was all recycled stuff from past years. He very carefully avoided all the uncomfortable facts of the year 2005 that were so damaging to his presidency. Didn't really talk about a lot of stuff. Badly misrepresented the facts on the ground and a number of other things. Of course, we're accustomed to the rosy scenarios that the White House paints about what's going on in Iraq. But we learned this week that New Orleans is the new Iraq. We get rosy pictures of the reconstruction of New Orleans while that city essentially withers and dies on the vine for lack of federal support and for lack of the kind of support that local and state officials in Louisiana think is necessary and appropriate. Interestingly, on that score, also there was a GAO, General Accounting Office report this week that came out that was very, very critical of the federal government's response in Katrina. And that report was simply rejected by the Department of Homeland Security and Michael Chertoff as being factually inaccurate. So there are a bunch of things like that that Bush doesn't talk about. And speaking of the Democrats not offering any real opposition, their spokesperson for the evening, Tim Kaine, the completely unknown moderate governor of Virginia, didn't talk at all about foreign policy. He really couldn't because, similarly to Maria Cantwell, his position on issues like Iraq is basically indistinguishable from Bush's. But he talked a lot about domestic issues. But again, there was really nothing there to get anybody excited. It's remarkable that Bush is in so much political trouble. He's got so many things going wrong for him right now, and yet the Democrats are not making any substantive gains about it in public opinion polls, in the races for Congress that are now underway for next November. They're just not picking up and making any headway because they're not offering concrete alternatives of their own, and because the public does not perceive that they're offering any real principled opposition and alternatives to what Republicans stand for. You know, their basic selling point is that they're not Republicans, and we got that during the State of the Union this week as well. Specifics for the State of the Union, he talked a lot about energy self-reliance. The goals for that were inadequate. Of course, there were no mentions of requiring Detroit to improve their mileage standards on cars, for example. He talked a lot about things like hydrogen, which he's talked about in past years. It was great to hear him talk this week about we need to kick America's you know, foreign oil dependence, but I mean, and dependence on oil. I mean, that was self-evident 5 years ago, and you know, if he were serious about that, he would also be serious about reducing carbon emissions and getting with the program on global warming and climate change. I mean, there's just, you know, you can go all the way through the speech, which I'm not going to do because plenty of other people have offered detailed rebuttals of almost everything that he said. There were just a lot of things in Bush's presentation that were either misrepresentations or omissions or simply inadequate, and it was real disappointing, but not especially surprising.
All right. Also this week, they came out with the proposed budgets, and I have the two headlines from our leading papers here in Seattle for Friday. The PI has billions more for wars in big black letters, which is, of course, shocking.
Yeah.
The other one, the Times, had Iraq war is costing $100,000 per minute is the headline.
Yeah, and it's all true. But there were a number of developments, budget-related developments this week that didn't garner those kind of headlines. Of course, earlier in the week, the House passed very narrowly, 216 to 214, along primarily party line votes, its proposed cuts to the budget, which were basically all on the backs of the poor. And then the Senate turned around this week and passed $70 billion in tax cuts, almost all for the rich, over the next 5 years. So what we're seeing is very much in Congress is very much a wealth transfer scheme from the poor to the rich, and those billions spent on war aren't being spent on the poor grunts in the field. They're being spent on Halliburton, they're being spent on Bechtel, they're being spent on arms manufacturers, you know, they're being spent on all the donors to the Republican Party that are getting rich off of these wars, who presumably would like to get even richer off of subsequent wars in places like Iran and Syria and Venezuela. We're going to keep seeing this again until there's any kind of meaningful opposition, and the Democrats are not providing opposition on the budget either. We saw the House budget cuts this week being directed primarily towards the poor, and we didn't see that much of an effort by Democrats. We saw opposition, obviously, to the final budget. But for example, there was all kinds of deal cutting going on, where between in the conference committees, away from the bright glare of C-SPAN, a deal was cut that resulted in a $22 billion windfall to the health insurance industry, while cutting out a program which would have cut costs and saved taxpayer dollars on the Medicaid program by enabling the federal government to get discounts on the drugs that it purchases. So again, it's all about benefiting the big corporations, and it's not about cutting taxes. Eddie Tooze on the Eat the State blog this week went through and did the math of the tax cuts that were made, minus the new spending that was announced this week, the spending on the wars and the spending on some of these other programs that were inserted in the budget, and came up with the fact that what we got this week was a net increase in federal spending. It wasn't a budget cut at all in terms of the overall budget, but it was a cut in programs that benefit students, that benefit the poor, that benefit the elderly, that benefit the infirm. And that's a pretty eloquent statement of where the Republican priorities are right now.
Well, I think it actually parallels the kind of this whole analogy of oil wells and drill pumping them out until the things collapse. I mean, there's only so long that you can keep pumping this money and resources out of the economy and out of the working class before the entire, you know, system.
Yeah, there's a fascinating economic trend going on right now, and I wish we had Maria here for this, because she could explain it far more eloquently than I can. But it's basically being called vendor financing, where China in particular, but also other Asian countries, are literally paying the United States to turn around and purchase its products, where countries like China and Korea and Japan own a big chunk of the debt in the American government. And there's an enormous trade surplus. The actual trade surplus for the United States is larger than the GDP for countries like Great Britain. It's just huge. And we can't afford to continue doing this kind of deficit consumer spending. It's just not going to happen. At some point, the economy is going to suffer as a result, as economies around the rest of the world and the central banks in some of these countries start shifting away from dollars, start shifting away from spending their money on pumping up the American economy, because there's only so much of it that can go on. The same thing's happening in the housing market, where there's been this long extended bubble where we've certainly seen that here in Seattle. There's only so much money to pay these exorbitant housing and rental costs of residential real estate. That kind of expansion of prices can only go on for so long, and it's really hurting a lot of people.
Didn't you say before we went live that the Pentagon is getting $200 million part of the budget for foreign spending?
Yeah, there was actually they're not getting the money. What they're doing is they're getting the authorization to spend money that they already have. This was a little known facet that was stuck into the Defense Appropriations Bill that was reported this week by the Washington Post. Apparently, there was a provision that was lobbied for very hard by Donald Rumsfeld and by the top Pentagon brass that, for the first time ever, allows the Pentagon to spend money up to $200 million directly on aid to foreign militaries. Now, what that means is that historically, U.S. foreign aid has all gone through the State Department, and there are restrictions on that. The State Department lists countries, for example, that are human rights violators, countries like Colombia and Indonesia, where we would be spending a lot more money on their militaries, directly on their militaries, if those militaries didn't have such abysmal records of mowing down and killing the civilians in their countries. What happens if the Pentagon is controlling that spending is that it circumvents a lot of those human rights restrictions, so that Donald Rumsfeld can turn around and spend money in Colombia, can spend money in the war on terror in Indonesia, and not have to worry about the fact that the Indonesian military has been accused of genocide in three different areas over the last 40 years, East Timor and Aceh province, and also the big sweep of communists in the mid-1960s. And the Indonesian military has never been held accountable for any of those crimes by any tribunal, international or domestic. So these are the kind of people that the Pentagon would like to do business with under Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush, and now they have the freedom to do so.
Yeah, they're just cutting out the middleman and passing the savings on to you. So
I don't think savings is exactly what they have in mind here.
I don't think I'm ever concerned about savings. All right, talk about the Valerie Plame update.
Yeah, several updates in the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation this week. Scooter Libby's trial date was set for January of 2007, very conveniently after the midterm elections in November. At the same time, it was revealed this week with newly non-redacted portions of previously secret federal grand jury testimony that Scooter Libby's lies, or alleged lies anyway, in the case were far more extensive than previously believed. He's in a great deal of legal jeopardy right now. He apparently told just one whopper after another to the Fitzgerald's investigators in this case. And there's also been reports this week that Fitzgerald is investigating very, very closely what he believes to be missing and probably destroyed evidence within the White House of emails relating to Valerie Wilson, Valerie Plame, by a number of top White House, to and from a number of top White House aides and staff, including Libby, including Dick Cheney, for that matter, talking about the organized campaign to out Plame and to try and discredit her husband, Joseph Wilson, an administration critic, that those emails have been referenced to by some of the people that were CC'd on the list, but Fitzgerald does not have copies of the emails, and they were not handed over to him when all appropriate records were subpoenaed a couple of years ago within the White House, and he's believing at this point that the White House may have intentionally destroyed that evidence. Keep an eye on this one, because it could mean this scandal resurfaces in a big way in 2006.
Okay, and coming up this next week, the Senate Judiciary hearings on the NSA?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what, if anything, comes out of the NSA hearings that the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to hold. Arlen Specter, the Republican chair of that committee, has been publicly quite critical of the NSA spying program, but the White House is refusing to hand over records, internal records that it has on the NSA spying program, to the Senate Judiciary Committee, even though it's being run by fellow Republicans. Specifically, they are refusing to hand over the internal legal opinions of White House attorneys as to whether the NSA spying program is legal or not. The speculation on this, of course, is that some people even within the White House were saying that there was questionable legality or that the program was not legal at all, and Bush went ahead with it anyway. For whatever reason, whatever combination of reasons, the White House has been fairly successful over the last several weeks in framing this issue, in spinning it its way, so that the whole debate over whether the NSA spying, warrantless spying, is legal or not, has been pretty effectively sidestepped. That's going to come front and center again this week, and Democrats are not going to be very happy with the stonewalling that the White House is going to do on these hearings.
Yeah, but the question is will they do anything about it?
That's always the question.
All right. Moving along to international, looking like there's further fallout from the Palestinian elections?
Yeah. The Palestinian Authority and Israel, under the Oslo Accord, pay each other for services on a number of different fronts. Israel, for example, pays the Palestinian Authority taxes. It pays for custom duties, things like that. And Israel this week announced that it was going to be withholding all such payments to the Palestinian Authority simply because it didn't like the way the election turned out. The fact that Fatah is no longer controlling the legislature and that Israel will have to deal with Hamas in the future. At the same time, there was a bit of good news this week. The United States and the European Union and Russia announced that they were not going to immediately, anyway, suspend foreign aid to the Palestinian Authority. This is really important, and the reason it's important is that the Palestinian economy is in such tatters due to the military occupation, due to all the checkpoints, due to the apartheid wall, due to the highways that carve Palestinian land into ever smaller Bantustans. It's a mess. Most people in Palestine are heavily, heavily dependent on foreign aid for their income, for their access to food. The threat to cut off that foreign aid because Western powers didn't like the fact that Hamas won the election is a real economic threat to most Palestinians. It's something that could be very serious. At the same time, it became even clearer this week that the electoral victory of Hamas is not just a Palestinian story. It's reverberating throughout the Middle East, all the way from Morocco to Iran, and the rise of Islamist parties throughout the region is something the United States is going to have to contend with, and it's a problem very much of the United States' own making. One of the reasons these parties have been successful is because the alternatives to them are all perceived as being closer to and more favorable toward the United States and the Bush administration. One of the reasons for the rise of these parties is a reaction to the fact that the United States is so despised in this part of the world. And it's not just the invasion of Iraq, it's also the decades of support for the military occupation of Palestine by Israel and United States support of Israel. And that's not going to change unless United States policy toward Israel and toward Palestine changes.
All right, and move over and talk about Iraq.
Yeah, a couple interesting things happened on Iraq this week. Robert Stein, Coalition Provisional Authority Comptroller and Funding Officer, pled guilty on a number of counts of bribery, conspiracy, money laundering, various other charges this week in, quote, and this is directly out of the New York Times, a scheme to use sexual favors, jewelry, and millions of dollars in cash to steer reconstruction funds to a corrupt contractor. The contractor, a guy named Philip Bloom, got $8 million in taxpayer money as a result of this scheme. And this is considered just the tip of another brand new scandal, and that was how Coalition Reconstruction money was spent and misspent. Of course, people who have been following this over the past couple of years know that there are literally billions of dollars that were unaccounted for by the Coalition Provisional Authority during that period, primarily in reconstruction money, just went right down the rat hole, and we're starting to get an idea of where that money went. Another interesting report this week in British TV that there was a memo of a January 2003 meeting. Now, this is a couple of months before the invasion, a meeting between Bush and Blair at which Bush announced that he was intending to go ahead and invade Iraq regardless of whether the UN Security Council approved or not. And there was a discussion eventually dismissed of trying to provoke Saddam into a war by disguising an American U-2 spy plane, painting it with United Nations colors, and then luring Saddam into firing on the plane. And that would have been a material breach of the various UN resolutions that were in effect at that time. So here's Bush talking about using deception, you know, painting a spy plane in UN colors in order to trick the world into thinking that Saddam needs to be attacked. More evidence that the Bush administration's rationale for and approach to selling the war in Iraq was fundamentally dishonest.
All right. Well, let's jump back to a little more local here in Washington State. Tim Iman has got another initiative up.
Yeah, the day before the gay civil rights bill was signed into law by Christine Gregoire, honoring Cal Anderson in the process, Iman announced that he's mounting an initiative campaign this fall to overturn that bill. This is not as much of a surprise as many of Iman's critics seem to think it is. Remember that long before Iman started doing tax cutting measures, he cut his teeth the very first initiative that he ever worked on, that he was not getting money for. He was doing it because he believed in it, was the I-200 measure. He doesn't like what he considers to be quotas, and this is an extension of that. So we're going to have a dogfight to try and keep the gay civil rights bill on the laws, on the ballot this fall, and it's going to be more red meat for the Republicans.
All right. And then quickly, the turns out, as we predicted, the King County Police Guild is putting up a fight for citizen oversight.
Yeah, the King County Police Officers Guild formally notified the county this week that it believes that the proposal that's being put forward by Julia Patterson and Bob Ferguson on the county council for a civilian oversight of the sheriff's office, the county sheriff's office, does need to be negotiated with the Police Officers Guild, and the guild is going to oppose the civilian oversight tooth and nail. Not much of a surprise at all, but still very disappointing. The county believes, and the county council believes, that it can impose this without going through the union. I think they're wrong. I think it does have to be negotiated with the guild. The state law is pretty clear on this point, that for a union contract, any substantive change in working conditions has to be negotiated, and civilian oversight would very clearly be a change in working conditions for police officers that now have no real accountability outside their own department.
All right. Well, with that, pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a community newspaper that covers these local and national and international affairs and has comics and all other kinds of cool stuff in it as well. You can find it where you find free newspapers. My God, what's happening over there? at bookstores, cafes, places like that. You can also find it on the web. www.eatthestate.org for the current issue, for back issues, for the blog, all sorts of cool stuff like that. And if you have comments, you have tips, you'd like to volunteer, you'd like to donate, feedback, anything like that, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.
Yeah, I think they're over playing a game of 52 CD pickup. So...